As I've already said elsewhere, to be a manager in tomorrow's more conscious organization is going to be markedly different from what we did in the past and what we're doing today. In the more conscious organization of our future, the E-Myth manager is less a manager than he or she is an entrepreneur, a creator of things, a conductor of an orchestra, an inventor, a leader, a philosopher, a stormy being with a hot purpose for being, a thoughtful person who loves the art and the science of manifesting thoughts into right action. Always in process, coming together in every moment that these creators live and work together for the purpose of becoming more than who they are. Said in more downtown terms, an E-Myth manager has got a lot to do. And the only way to do it is through a system. This is what your system would look like if you were to do the thing I'm talking about doing here. Picture any day you wish. You come into your office. In front of you on your computer is a picture of your day in living animated color. Your computer tells you what is going to happen today. It's reviewed the past, summarized its conclusions about the past in relationship to all of the strategic indicators of your business, which are the things that are most important to you. Revenue, cost of fulfilling your commitments, direct and indirect, last week on this day, the week before that, the week before that, the trend of all those weeks, the month before, the year before, everything related to this particular day and time, especially last year on exactly this day, and the year before, and the year before that, and before that, and before that, and so forth, for as long back as it's relevant, your computer does all this for you, gives you the particulars you need to know without you ever having to think about it. And so the first part of this management system of yours is the retrieval of data concerning everything you need to know and everything you need to do to see your accountabilities whole in one piece in a seamless way. And then, of course, is the future. Your management system, this mythical system I'm projecting into your business, must tell you about your future, must calculate the implications of competitive intrusion. It must calculate the implications of demographic changes. It must look at the geography in which you do business and tell you what the implications are of a freeway being torn down, of a building going up, of a neighborhood going to seed, of traffic count and body count and crime and education, of kids going to prison, of yuppies going to hell in a handbasket, of the media and the music and the way people are dressing and are likely to dress, and of old people and aging people, of Social Security and the contract with America. Your computer, your management system, of course, will tell you all this and much, much more, because without it, how in the world are you going to manage anything? How indeed? There is no way in the world you're going to manage anything, and there never has been. The E-Myth manager knows all this. He better, because if you fail to accept this absolutely verifiable fact that you can't manage anything, that no one today and no one yesterday could manage anything other than the most inane of things, you'll be eaten alive by your own ignorance. So then, what then? If you can't manage anything, then what's the role of the manager? Oh, I'm so glad you asked me this question, but I think you're going to hate the answer. The role of the manager is to engage with the present in a fully enlightened manner while inventing the future. Let me say that again. The role of the manager is to engage with the present in a fully enlightened manner while inventing the future. And let me tell you how I came to this conclusion. It is because history has told us that none of the data about your past and about your future has anything at all to do with the truth. The truth is waiting to be invented. The truth isn't a fact, like so many would have us believe. It's a fiction. It's your fiction. It's being invented in the moment, whether you want to believe it or not. You are inventing it. Even now, as we sit here together, you are inventing your future. You are attracting to yourself everything you believe or don't believe in. And it doesn't matter how you got here, you did, and that's for sure. But what difference does it make? You're inventing your future. If you walk away angry, what you do next is a product of that. And then the next thing you do is a product of that, and so forth, and so on, ad infinitum and ad nauseum, you're inventing your future. So listen to me, eMyth Manager. There is no perfect system solution that's going to save you from yourself. There's no magic box out there that's going to make you a magician. There's no technology in the world or in the future of the world which is going to save you from yourself. Not Microsoft Office 777.9, not Bill Gates and his next killer app to be invented, not the next internationally acclaimed intra-extra-convivial net game resource, RamIM.com coming now to your telephonically correct Java, Nava, Netscape. Do you can't get there from here. You can't. I'm telling you, the future is as bleak as your worst teenage days. God, I hope things get better, but for the life of me, I doubt they will, no matter what Tony Robbins says. And then there is my son, Sam, who just turned 9, flying his remote control plane. This is something he's yet to do. He's now in the process of creating the plane. It sits on his bed unfinished. But I know it is finished in his mind. Sam looks at his plane every day, and every day something gets finished. Not everything, but something. Not all of it, but some of it. And yet, even now, as the plane sits there on Sam's bed, it is flying. It has been flying. It was begun to fly even before he bought it, before he put the first thing of it together. It was flying in his mind. That's where flight begins, in the mind. That's where Sam begins. But hear me about this. If there were not Sam's heart, there would not be Sam's mind. Flight is more than a sterile idea. It is a passion. And that's what gives the plane its wings. The joy, the sheer unmitigated joy of seeing the thing itself up there, far beyond a little boy's bed, in the world of birds, in clouds, and the soaring blue sky. So that's the first part of a management system, innovation. Innovation is the reinvention of what it is to create what could be. And every manager must do this on an ongoing basis. But in a business, in a commercial enterprise, just doing innovation without an understanding of where one is meant to be is a waste of energy, a monumental waste of time. So innovation in a commercial enterprise needs a result, and the result is to become what the company was designed to become, and that's why the strategic objective of the company is so critical. It guides the innovation. At the eMyth Academy, our strategic objective is to become the preeminent provider of small business development services and products worldwide. The result of this objective, to transform small business worldwide, one small business owner at a time, and this is the direction to which our managers are aimed. All of what we do is intended to take us there. Where are you aimed? What is it you're intending to do? That, then, is the guiding light of all your innovation.
Okay, question.
Yes. Innovative thinking. Do you have any guidelines for innovative thinking?
Sure. Innovative thinking is very, very, very simple. Effectively, what you have to ask yourself first is, who is it I am attempting to impact through this innovative thinking? In other words, who's the target of this thought? Is it a customer? Is it an employee? Is it a supplier? Is it a lender? Is it my boss? Is it a subordinate? Is it this? Is it that? Who is it? First of all, who? So the demographics become very, very critical. The second thing is, what do they want? So obviously, before you start to innovate, you got to ask, what do they want? The third thing is, how are they currently getting it, if they're getting it? Right? And so I begin to see the way in which they're accustomed to getting what they want. And what's missing in that process? In other words, what could be gotten, if I could think of it, that can considerably increase their satisfaction from that process? And having identified what it is they don't like about what they're getting and the way in which they're getting it, and what they do want about what they're seeking by going out to get it, I can then begin to ask the question, what is the one thing I could do in this process that they perceive and I perceive and my people perceive and the competition perceives is impossible to do. But if I could do it, would immediately transform their experience of getting it and then going ahead to do that. That's all innovation is. Okay? Great. But there's another thing about this whole thing about innovation. The problem is that most innovation doesn't occur because most people are trying to solve problems. And what I'm going to suggest to every e-myth manager in this room is e-myth managers do not solve problems. They identify and seize opportunities. That's not just rhetoric. It's an absolute shift of attention. Remember, we must begin to think in a completely original way. Completely original way, for example, is to think about opportunities as opposed to problems. You're not there to solve problems. You're there to seize opportunities. To the degree you're able to identify opportunities, everything will change in your business and everything will change about the mindset of your people. People who are constantly trying to solve problems only discover there's another problem to solve. Problems are unending. Opportunities are unending. But the beauty of opportunities is they always produce more than solving problems do. You see, when you become a master at seizing opportunities, of understanding them, something extraordinary happens. So Disney has a dreaming room. And in the dreaming room at Disney, all they think about are opportunities. No one's allowed to say, yeah, but, what if, et cetera, and so forth. Nobody's allowed to bring into the question all of the reasons why we couldn't. In the dreaming room, anybody who does that is thrown out of the room. The only thing we're here to talk about are opportunities. What if, what if, what if, what if? And you say, yeah, but we can't. But what if we could? But what if we could? The second part of your management system is quantification. Everything you do in your business, everything you manage produces a result of some sort. And the reality you create has a measure to it, a time, a quantity, a set of conditions which you can record and then recall in relationship to the results of the same process, the same event performed at a later time, and that relationship between one event and a string of events in your business and another event and a string of events which follow the same action is what I call here quantification. Innovation without quantification is deadly because it confuses the issue. Innovation, which is only perceived to be an improvement, but has not been quantified as one, creates a false air of accomplishment when in fact it could mean exactly the opposite. You don't want to innovate without quantifying the impact of your innovation because it distracts you from more important things, such as being clear about why you're doing what you're doing, such as being clear about what your strategic objective is, such as knowing who you're doing this for. This work you spend so much time at, this work which keeps you from so many other things you could be doing instead, this work you do for what we've come to call a living. So quantification, truly knowing the numbers of your business and caring about them, is critical if the innovation is to have any relevance to the day-to-day results you and your people are there to produce together. And finally, there's orchestration. Orchestration is the third component of your management strategy. The organization of results and the work which produced them into a replicatable experience. I watched a landscape contractor I had hired move rocks in my yard with a backhoe. Big rocks. The guy was obviously an expert with a backhoe. He loved what he was doing. Yet each and every time he did it, each time he went to work on a different rock, I noticed that he dealt with it differently. He used a different technique for each rock. I asked him why, and he responded much as you'd expect him to respond, that each rock was quite different from the other rocks before it. Each rock, he said, was unique, requiring a unique approach. You can never tell, he said, what you're going to be called upon to do by the next rock. But that wasn't all, he said to me. Not only are each of the rocks he is confronted with from job to job and day to day different from the ones which preceded them and the ones to follow, but just about everything else is different, too. In my case, he went on, the pond we were building together was the very first pond of its kind he had ever built. Oh, he'd built many ponds before it, of course. I wouldn't have hired him. But this pond was of a shape, depth, and character, given the location of it in my property, and given the characteristics of it, too numerous to mention here. This pond was definitely unique, calling for strategies which themselves were also first-time strategies, calling for techniques which themselves were first-time techniques. Which meant to say that to do his job called for an expert, an artist, a consummately skilled artisan with an abundance of experience which could not be replicated by anyone else lacking those exceptional qualities, let alone by him. If every job was different, every job called for a new creation. And so, he finally concluded for me, each day he woke up was a different one from the one preceding it and the one to follow, and so it was that he could never find anyone who could replace him because no one but no one had the patience, let alone the judgment, to deal with the infinite variety of decisions he had to cope with, and certainly no one but no one could be trusted to hold his financial balance in their less than competent hands. So it was that every job he did, he did. And he knew, as certainly as I could tell he knew, that nothing would ever convince him of anything different. But despite that, and despite his conviction of the uniqueness of every facet of his day, I couldn't help but notice as I continued to watch him that there was a very specific way to lift the shovel on the backhoe, and there was as well a very specific way to move it from the left to the right, and that there was also a very specific distance he placed the seat he sat in on the backhoe from the levers he pushed and pulled, and that he placed himself in exactly that same place each and every time he used the shovel. And I couldn't help but notice that rocks of a certain size he lifted with the shovel itself, and that rocks of another size he lifted with the use of chains, which themselves were adjusted in identically the same way from rock to rock, and that he used identically the same gestures for identically the same reasons over and over again, no matter what the location the rock was being placed in, and no matter what size the rock was, and no matter how steep the ground was, and no matter how late it was in the afternoon or how early in the morning. In other words, while my contractor friend was obviously convinced that nothing he did could be replicated, in fact, there was a great deal he did which not only could, but was. The question only remained, I thought to myself, how many other things that he does could be replicated other than the few I've just mentioned. And let me say to you here that there are many, 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 many. Indeed, it has been my experience that most of what man does can be replicated given the thought, the attention, and the interest. And so, orchestration is a primary accountability of the E-Myth manager, if only so that my contractor can expand his area of control to include more people less skilled than he, to include more results than he himself is able to accomplish, to include more opportunities than those he has limited himself to, and to include more challenges than those with which he has been willing to engage. And he has accomplished all of these limitations by a habit of mind which persists in thinking of his lot in life as one in which he has been designated by the Lord above and the earthly powers below that be to come up with original ways of doing things which do not call for original ways of doing them at all. And because so much of his time and energy are taken up in this manner, avoiding those things which do call for original ways of doing them. A habit of mind which has cost my friend dearly over time and which will continue to cost him dearly if he fails to change it. Your management strategy, then, is that which enables you to fulfill your primary aim and your strategic objective through an organizational strategy that fulfills your promise to yourself, your company, your people, your suppliers, your community, and your customer in the best imaginable way possible, and then monitors that way, that process, that system, to find ways to sustain, improve, and transform its effectiveness. Thank you. Okay, so let's talk about people development. There's a first step in the process with attracting people. You're going to approach your people for the very first time. How do you do that? You're going to create what I call a recruitment seminar. And this recruitment seminar is for the people we've got as well as for the people we don't. And the recruitment seminar starts with a positioning statement. The positioning statement says, essentially, what you truly are looking for. Now, I want you to imagine that as a classified ad. You may have heard this before, but hear me, in this context, it's absolutely critically important. Wanted. This is what the ad says. People with passion, people with heart. That's what the ad says. You're about to recruit your own people. You're about to hire all of your people all over again. You're about to start your business all over again. And you think I'm saying that metaphorically, I'm saying that literally. You're about to start your business all over again. Now, you're not going to do this tomorrow. So you're going to do this later. When you truly understand this, when you truly get it yourself, and when you truly experience the power of it, which will not happen tomorrow. It will happen over time. And effectively, what you'll discover is the serious omission that every manager of any organization is living with, that they have never corrected. And until they correct that omission, until it becomes something they literally do proactively and consciously for a very specific reason, nothing will ever change. All the ISO 9000, all the stuff that you've been introduced to, and I'm sure you have, all the engineered solutions to getting better results will only dig your hole deeper. They will never, ever increase your relationship with your people. They will never create what I'm here to call the intimate organization. Understand, until you own an intimate organization, you are sucking wind in your business forever. And that's a huge leap. But it starts with a commitment. And the commitment says, wanted, people with passion, people with heart. Have you ever wished to work in a professional environment, people you truly care for? Doing professional work in a professional way, producing professional results, and experiencing the transformation of your life in the process, well, now you can. We're the name of your business. And we tell what you do. And we're growing, and we're thriving, and we're looking for players. But we're on a fast track, so you better be in a hurry. Call my number. Let's talk. Let's see if you're ready. That's the ad. Now, what will happen in that ad? I'm sure that you need experienced people, but what I'm saying is that we're going to attract inexperienced people. So we're going to attract inexperienced people to our business. But what we're going to build into our business is the ability to teach inexperienced people to become very, very experienced people. Because what we're going to make the difference up with is a system. And so what I'm suggesting is that most managers abdicate accountability for effectively what really needs to be done, which is I need to create an expert system in my business that enables a non-expert to begin to produce expert results in short order. So what I want you to know is the nature of work is completely transforming all around us. Every place we look, it's transforming around us. And the problem with most managers is they've gone to sleep in relationship to it because it terrifies them what it's going to do to what they do. But rather than being terrified and hiding our heads in the sand, what I'm suggesting is it's an opportunity unparalleled to produce significantly greater results with people who could never do that on their own. Because you've begun to approach your business in a truly entrepreneurial way. And I'm suggesting that's the opportunity. So the ad says, no experience necessary. We'll teach you all you need to know. All you got to have is heart, commitment, and passion. And then they call, and they will call. They'll call by the hundreds. And I don't care what the position is. They will call. I know that. We've run the ad. And when they call, you say, whoops, we don't have the time to talk to you right now, but we do have a meeting on and a meeting on. Which time would be best for you? It'll take about 40 minutes of your time, and during that 40 minutes, you're going to hear our story. And when you hear our story, it's going to do one of two things to you. It's either going to tell you want to be here or you don't. Now, hear me. I know I'm talking about the people you got. This is metaphorical in a way. And so what I'm saying is that every business needs to re-engage the people you got first. And the people you don't, second. And you got to give them an opportunity to rise to the occasion. But understand, the people you got are more skeptical than the people you don't got. The people you got know you how you are. So then they come to the seminar, the meeting, whatever you want to call it. And you get up in front of them and you say, you know, I've been thinking about our business. Hell, I've been thinking about it a lot. And the truth of the matter is, the way we do business really doesn't work. I decided what I wanted to do is I wanted to try something different. What I wanted to try to do is to engage each and every one of you in an individual conversation. Really, the conversation is not going to be me talking at you. It's about you talking to me. Because what I really believe is that everybody wants to be productive. Everybody really wants to be a winner at what they do. Problem is, the way the system usually is set up, it's very difficult to do that. I bet you'd agree with that. So I'm going to sit and listen to the words, sit and listen to the ideas, sit and listen to the perspectives. And then I'm going to come back to you and tell you a story. And understand that story is not going to be created lightly. That story is going to be created honestly. Because candidly, whether you know it or not, what I'd love to do is to produce the best result I'm capable of doing. You're creating the story. You're creating the story, which is called your strategic objective. You're creating your strategic objective in concert with a strategic objective which exists in the company that you're a part of or does not. And if it does not, then hear me. You've got to make a choice. You're either going to do it for yourself despite the lack of strategy, despite the lack of a strategic objective, despite the lack of consciousness in the managers you report to, for your own sake, or you're going to go someplace else. So that's the choice. These are hard choices. I'm talking about hard choices in real life because it's your only life. You have no other life to go to. And every single day you stay in the one you got, what do you get? More of the same, but less life. So I'm trading my life every single day for the choices I make. Your job is to forge a pact with your people. But until you can know what they want for their life, honestly, you see, honestly, not BS, honestly, what do you want from your life? What's your primary aim? You got to get your people to answer that question. Because my business becomes a means through which we both get what we want. We both get what we want. It's on the table. Hear me. You want maximum commitment from your people? You got to give maximum commitment. My primary aim, your primary aim. I want this for our life. This is where our business is going. I want your help. You're going to become an apprentice in my business. People development is about three stages. The three stages are simple. And they are apprenticeship, they are craftsmanship, and they are mastery. Technician in your business must begin as an apprentice, no matter how much experience they've got. You must go through the steps. And the steps of apprenticeship in your business must be specific. Specific. These are the things you must learn to do to get to the next stage of your development, which is craftsman. The word that defines an apprentice is faith. The word that defines a craftsman is hope. The word that defines a master is charity. How many of you have ever heard that? Faith, hope, and charity. The Freemasons. Freemasons called it faith, hope, and charity because effectively an apprentice can have nothing other than faith to go on. Faith in what? Faith in your integrity. Faith in the system.
Faith that, in fact, you truly want what you say you want. Faith that they can become a craftsman. Craftsman now is not living in faith because they've already verified for themselves that, in fact, I can become a craftsman. I can only hope that I can become a master. The master now has a relationship with God, which essentially says, turn around and help others up the ladder. Faith, hope, and charity. Can you imagine if you instilled that into your business? Can you see the difference, the change of attention, the alteration of intention, the whole way in which the business turns into what a business could be today in the most remarkable way we could imagine, which is a school? Your business could become a school. Your business could speak to the highest ethical principle. Your business could become a school. And in the process of doing this, become more productive than any business such as yours could ever be imagined to be. Understand, I'm not talking about giving up profit. I said earlier that profit is absolutely critical for a business to do more than survive, but to thrive. But effectively, if your people don't understand the rule of profit, if your people don't understand the rule of money, if your people don't understand the rule of return on investment or the rule of return on equity, if your people are stupid and kept ignorant, focused on stupid work, instead of on the application of that work toward producing a sublime conclusion, then effectively you're restricting your people from knowledge. You're restricting your people from understanding, and no wonder in an environment such as that, people end up becoming us and them, feeling abused, feeling used, feeling like victims, because in fact they are. They're being kept from the golden chalice. They're being kept from the golden rule. They're being kept from the way it works. They're being enslaved to do it, do it, do it, do it without any gain beyond having a job. And let me tell you, you keep people in that position and you will create absolute, absolute turmoil, chaos, enmity. You have to give people the power to transform. You have to help them to transform and move up the ladder. You have to create a system through which they can do that. And people development of any other kind is nonsense.
People are also not who we think they are. I've said it time and time again. Managers are not here to manage people. People are unmanageable. Try to manage someone and you create an object out of them. Create an object out of them and you have simultaneously created an object out of yourself in relationship to them. Do that and you create resistance. Resistance in the person you're attempting to manage, as well as resistance in yourself. Create resistance and you create conflict. Create conflict and you create exactly the opposite of what is required to produce results through other people. No, the manager I'm talking about, the E-Myth manager, understands this dynamic only too well, and so spends his or her time avoiding it with a passion. What he or she manages instead is the system, the way we do it here, while engaging people in understanding the system, in sustaining the system, in practicing the system, in improving the system, in transforming the system. Having said all that, it's important for you to understand that there is a human side to this that cannot be avoided, and in fact, makes the work of the manager increasingly more sophisticated, increasingly more challenging, if not always more enjoyable. Because every manager within earshot of this recording has come face to face with, and will continue to come face to face with, an extraordinary range of human strategies which tend to complicate the relationship between the players of this game called business to an oftentimes impossible degree if one doesn't understand them and if one isn't prepared for them. You'll not find what follows in any text whatsoever. I'll tell you that in advance. And so I need to qualify what I'm about to say as a admittedly highly personalized, dangerously subjective viewpoint of mine and mine alone, but one which my experience over the 60 years I've lived here on the face of this diabolically insane earth bears out over and over and over again as the undeniable, unmitigated, absolute truth. Only you and your experience can bear me out or fly in the face of what I'm about to share with you. In advance of that, I say I humbly bow to your judgment. Now, I said above that you'll come face to face with an extraordinary range of human strategies in the course of being a manager. Let me tell you what I mean by that. A human strategy is what each and every one of us unconsciously designs very early on in our pubescent years to protect us from what we perceive as life-threatening dangers. Ultimately, our human strategy works its way out from day to day in the form of what we call our unique personality. What I've discovered is that there are a predictable number of human strategies which you will be confronted with as a manager over and over and over again. And knowing that, I feel it is my obligation to introduce you to them so that you can begin to prepare yourself to engage with them much more effectively than you do at the moment or that you've ever done in the past. The first of the human strategies I wish to share with you is called the grunt. The grunt is a cynic who does a day's work for a day's pay. He or she isn't interested in anything else when it comes to the job or the business. Not ideas, not visions, not teamwork, not results. The grunt knows that everyone is out for himself, that the world is a dangerous place in which only the dishonest succeed, and that when anyone succeeds, it's always at the expense of the grunt. This includes the government, the educational system, the legal system, are you with me, the business system. Anything and everything that goes on in the world is included in the grunt's picture of manipulation and excess at his or her expense. The grunt, therefore, wants to be left alone, or, if he's more social than that, his social tendency is to carp about everything and everyone. He cannot be won over, so don't even try, because to be won over is to be used. The grunt has already made up his mind about everything and is determined not to be convinced that he's wrong. There is a grunt in all of us. The second strategy is the mercenary. The mercenary is excellent at what he does and sells himself to the highest bidder. In short, he has no loyalty to anything other than to himself and his expertise. He sells that expertise for money, with the money and the inference that if he's paid that much, he's worth more than anyone else. The mercenary has created a position in the world among the best of the best, which gives him his identity and reinforces his own self-esteem. In short, what he does is who he is. What you want the mercenary to do is either possible or not. The harder it is to do, the more it will cost you. If you want him to do the impossible, however, he'll more than likely refuse, since for the mercenary to fail diminishes his perceived value. On the other hand, what is impossible for most people to do is raw meat for the mercenary, and so more often than not, the impossible is looked upon as an exciting opportunity for the best mercenaries among us, since if it is impossible for other people to do, and he succeeds at doing it, his perceived value rises to giddy heights. And of course, his perceived value is all the mercenary has to sell. The mercenary is a complete narcissist. So given the narcissistic tendencies of business and organizations today, it's no wonder we find ourselves inundated with mercenaries of all types on the mercenary food chain. Wannabes, on-the-way-ups, on-the-way-downs, failed mercenaries, successful mercenaries, mercenary champs like Michael Eisner at Disney or Bill Gates at Microsoft. There's a mercenary in all of us. The third strategy is the patriot. The patriot is the true believer. He believes in causes, companies, charismatic people, ideas, and he gives himself up totally to those things. He does so willingly because the patriot has forsaken belief in himself. The patriot craves to find something or someone to believe in on the outside because he's failed to find someone or something on the inside. Therefore, the patriot can become, and in history has become, very, very dangerous. Once you let the patriot down, once you fall off your pedestal, once you fail the patriot, and you will fail the patriot, his needs are so unrealistic, he'll turn on you, sometimes fatally. It is difficult for a manager to give up a good patriot, and that's the problem. He or she is willing to do whatever it takes, no matter how impossible the task, no matter how many hours are needed, no matter what the price he or she is asked to pay to serve the cause, his leader, his saint. Price to the good patriot is no object. He is willing to pay any price, even more than he has. He's on a mission from God, as the Blues Brothers so aptly put. But to nurture the patriot's vice of personal immolation for the cause, for a purely pragmatic mission, is to put yourself and your organization in harm's way. The patriot is known to hold a grudge for a very long, long time, and will explode irrationally for absolutely no discernible reason other than his own internal inexplicable ones, which have been simmering beneath the compliant surface for a very long time. There is a patriot in all of us. The fourth strategy I'd like to cover here is the student. The student is the manager's greatest opportunity and greatest obligation. The student loves to learn, wishes to be taught, wants to know, craves a teacher. For a true student, any subject is worthy of his or her interest, whether it be the nature of work or how to set a fence post in the ground. A good student is as passionate about universal ideas as he is about seemingly inconsequential tasks. No matter how much experience a good student has had, he will always be willing to become an apprentice. Apprenticeship to the good student is a natural way of life, because if the purpose of the student is to continually learn and discover the secrets life has to reveal to him, then no sooner does he become a master of one secret, one skill, one idea, than he discovers something he doesn't know and immediately reverts to the apprentice status the student knows and loves so well, as it represents to him the beginning of the continuous process of evolution, of the meaning of life, of learning. There is a student in all of us. The fifth strategy is that of the inventor. The inventor is a continuous surprise to everyone around him. He has the ability and the desire to see opportunities where none seem to exist. More important, he's willing to pursue those opportunities to a point where he has either validated them or determined their lack of value. If the first, he can engage others in the next stage of development until the foreign opportunity is converted into a permanent part of the organization's life, leaving the inventor to go on to richer pastures in the next opportunity, and then, of course, the next and the next and the next. This is the way of the inventor. Next, next, next. Great inventors end up leading enterprises, but they can also be found at the very bottom of an organization, battering around inconsequentially from this to that, never truly taking hold of their natural ability, squandering their time, their energy, and their interest. Once discovered in an organization, the inventor should be nurtured carefully to help him or her fulfill his potential. The question for the inventor is, how do I accept my gift and yet maintain balance within an organization in which I could easily become thought of as a dilettante, a dreamer, or worse, a nuisance, a continuous annoyance? There is an inventor in all of us. The sixth strategy, and the last I will deal with here, is what I call the nice guy. Everyone knows the nice guy. He's eager to please everyone and to serve no one. The nice guy is always a nice guy until he or she is asked to do something he doesn't want to do. Rather than put himself into that position, however, the nice guy avoids all potential conflicts of this sort by continually keeping himself busy with the busy work every organization manages to create. And because the nice guy is so willing to keep busy doing the trivia and good housekeeping that each of us ends up having to do and not wanting to do, the nice guy makes himself useful by taking our trivia off our shoulders and putting it all on his own. How can you fault a guy like that? Well, of course you can't. And that's the way the nice guy likes it. Until you ask him for something he doesn't want to do, that is. Ask the nice guy to do something important, like grow personally, and the passive-aggressive nature of the nice guy suddenly and very emphatically reveals itself. End of Mr. Nice Guy, beginning of a sullen battle only Mr. Nice Guy can win. There's a nice guy in all of us.